From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, mean, hostile comments. They seem to be everywhere on every online story.
Having negative comments isn't just like, oh, well, that's the internet. It really is having a negative effect on how we think about things and how people interact with people around them.
Is civility a thing of the past? Plus, Michigan Supreme Court Justice Bridget Mary McCormick.
I guess the thing that surprised me the most is how collegial and high-functioning this court has been these last 2 years.
Then teachers at one high school have figured out how to get kids excited about gym class and wood shop at the same time.
We don't have to force feed knowledge and information to these kids. They're going out and they're discovering it on their own.
Those stories and more. Here's a name you probably heard at one point or another. Dan Gilbert. The national media have called him Detroit's savior. But as one local writer puts it, there are still stories that need to be told. I'm Lester Graham sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Today, how to cover a so-called savior. But first, the Michigan Supreme Court has decided some 52 cases this year dealt with judicial misconduct, and we'll see a change on the bench next year. Justice Bridget Mary McCormick was elected to the state's highest court in 2012. Welcome back to Stateside. You have been there for a couple of years now, and I'm just curious as can be if you can pull back the velvet curtain a little bit. What have been things that surprised you about how the Supreme Court operates?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It's great to be back here. And thanks for that question. I have to say there's a lot that surprised me. Even though I, as an advocate, practiced in that court, there's still a lot that you don't know because the court operates largely confidentially. So what surprised me the most? I guess the thing that surprised me the most is how collegial and high-functioning this court has been these last 2 years. The numbers kind of show that, but our opinions last term, there were none decided along partisan lines. There were a record number of unanimous opinions. And so in addition to how our collegiality is reflected in our work product, we really like each other and get along.
So that's something we hear a lot about, you know, how many Republicans there are, how many Democrats are on the bench, how it affects decisions. You're saying that partisan politics doesn't have that much to do with the final product of the Supreme Court.
Certainly doesn't. I mean, you don't have to completely take my word for it because there's this data point in our decisions, even though the media likes to describe our decisions in terms of which party nominated us, about where we landed on the outcomes, but they didn't have a lot to work with last term because we didn't give them any.
I want to talk to you about campaigns. You know, I've worked with Rich Robinson. I've talked to Marilyn Kelly, your predecessor on the bench, about campaigns and judicial campaigns in particular. Right now, there's a lot more money being spent on campaign ads for justice candidates from independent sources rather than the campaigns themselves. Often the people behind this money are not known. Many of the justices have expressed some support for change, although not all. What will it take to get dark money out of the Supreme Court justices' election campaigns, or should it be taken out?
Well, I think, you know, there are some points about this very big topic, you know, and there are a gazillion subpoints in it, but there are some points about which I think almost everybody agrees. And the most important one might be the price we pay for the public's perception of how we do our work because of that kind of spending, right? I mean, when you said before, people don't know who funds those campaigns, not only does the public not know? We don't know. You know, so you know, in this last campaign, there were advertisements by interest groups that had nothing to do with, in fact, it's illegal for the candidate campaigns to work together with the interest groups. So the candidates themselves didn't have any control over those ads, probably wouldn't have selected the particular ads that were used. But at the end of all that, the public is left with this sense that we must be working in some kind of way to support the different interest groups that support us. And that's too bad since you know, like I started out this interview, I don't think the data supports that. And I can tell you from my personal experience in the back room, it's not how we work.
So how badly do you think that affects the public's perception of impartiality from the bench?
I mean, from all of the studies I've seen, that it is across the board the case that the public believes that there is more politics than or some politics when there isn't. And I think it has to be the result of this kind of spending in these campaigns. So I think it's too bad. I think it costs us in important ways because, you know, frankly, the court really has this different role in a constitutional democracy than the other branches. We are kind of the honest broker in government, which means we have to, you know, call it straight, even if, you know, we don't like the particular outcome that we're delivering personally. You know, even if we were in the legislature, we might have voted for some different policy. Our job is not to sort all that out, right? We play this different role. And it kind of matters that people understand that and believe that our outcomes are partisan free, and they are. But I worry that sometimes elections undermine that. I mean, in addition to just, I feel like I'm talking just about our opinions, but we have this other big job in administering all the courts of the state. And frankly, you know, most people don't come to the Supreme Court. They go to, you know, when most people I know need a little bit of justice or have a little bit of justice being demanded of them, they're in their local courts, in the district court, the circuit court. But it's the Supreme Court's job to make sure all of that is running well for the public. And frankly, we've done an incredible job, and we can talk about it, on that part of our docket as well. And I think
I actually do want to talk about
okay,
that.
Good. But I think that's another piece of, you know, our working together well.
I want to ask you one more thing about this, though, because there's been a task force. They put out a report two and a half years ago making recommendations about how to deal with this campaign issue. Has that done anything except for sit on a shelf or be discussed in legislative hearings? I mean, what can be done to make sure that this problem is dealt with?
So I think some of the recommendations they made, I mean, so they're going to take a lot of movement to get anywhere, but some of them are pretty specific, like getting the party nomination process out of judicial elections. I'm not sure anybody disagrees with that. So if there's a way for the legislature to get that done, I bet there would be pretty broad support for that. That's the kind of thing where if you could just take the parties out of these elections, it would help with this public perception problem, right?
So candidates could still probably get some kind of endorsement, but it wouldn't be the party deciding who the nominee is.
Hopefully they wouldn't, yeah. But at least the parties wouldn't control who the nominee is. Because, I mean, you know how the nomination process works. In both parties, there are all sorts of hoops and hurdles. And, like, who wants that in this branch of government that I said before plays this kind of different and important role?
Richard Bernstein's going to be on the bench. He's the new justice. How might that change things as far as the next term?
Well, in two ways. Number one, we're losing Mike Kavanaugh. And that, I should say first, is heartbreaking to all of us because he has been he will have served 32 years on this court. He's our historian. He's our comedian. He plays a lot of roles that nobody else can play. We all admit it.
And so the justices had a comedian.
We do. He's dry humor. He's perfect just at the right moments. But we're excited to have Richard join us. And we always think that a new voice at the table, especially one bringing sort of a different perspective than the rest of the voices around the table, is good for our institution, just like it's good for any institution. So we are eager to have him join us, while a little sad at the same time to be losing Justice Kavanaugh.
Okay. Richard Mary McCormick is Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court. Thanks very much for coming in. Thanks for talking candidly with us.
Oh, I appreciate it.
One of the books making lots of the best books of 2014 list was set largely here in Michigan, though for Michigan Radio's Tamar Charney, it might have hit a little too close to home because books about life in Michigan after a pandemic might not be what you want to read when you're sick.
I was up north on a rainy weekend with only 100 pages left in the last book on my reading list. Luckily, Petoskey has a real bookstore. "Can I help you?" asked the guy working at McLean and Aiken. "I don't know what to read next," I said. We talked briefly about what I'd read recently, and then he said, "Here's one we're really recommending. It's called Station 11. It's not gone over well with a lot of our regulars because it's set after a pandemic wipes everybody out." I'm thinking, oh, that is so not my kind of book. But he continues, "It's a National Book Award book, and it's about a symphony that travels along Lake Michigan and Huron performing Shakespeare." How did I not hear about this? So I bought it, I started it, and then I got a nasty cold. Station 11 is set against the pandemic scenario the epidemiologists are always on about. You know, a deadly flu starts in some far-flung place? In the book, it's Georgia, as in former Soviet Union Georgia. And it quickly spreads by airline passengers, and in mere weeks has wiped out 99% of the population. Without people, there's no one to transport fuel, keep electricity going, and maintain the infrastructure that powers modern life. Everything collapses. I've seriously worried about society being on the brink of collapse twice now. Once on 9/11, when our building was evacuated for a bomb threat not long after the second tower fell. The other time was when the grid went down across the upper Midwest, taking the gas pumps, ATMs, and other foundations of modern life with it. Each time, as I started to think about what would happen and what I'd do next, I think the answer would be to head north, to northern Michigan, to Petoskey. It's where I go when I need to escape. So there I am, blowing my nose, reading a book about a web of characters and their lives before, during, and after the pandemic. And oh yeah, what life in northern Michigan is like when civilization collapses. It isn't pretty. It's violent, the temperature's extreme, and life is hard. But slowly, people learn to adapt. They eke out an existence. And then they start to reach for more. A museum of civilization, a performance group, a librarian in New Petoskey starts a newspaper, and a community that's rediscovered electricity is seen in the distance from an abandoned air traffic control tower. The author, Emily St. John Mandel, is from Canada. She lives in New York and has pretty much only been here on book tour. But her book touched a nerve of pride. In this fictional post-apocalypse Michigan, the people here rebuilt the things that make us humans human: art, markers of things past, technology, and media. Perhaps it's a metaphor for what this state has been through. Our economy, our cities, and many of our neighbors have hit really hard times. But in the midst of it all, our artists, writers, and innovators have helped people move forward. It's pretty much what's happening in Midtown Detroit. 20 years ago, I worked in the Cass Corridor. It was a dangerous place where my car was vandalized a bunch of times. People I knew were carjacked, and a police officer even advised us to run red lights if things felt sketchy. But today, it's a hotspot of quirky businesses, artists, and tech incubators. Maybe Mandel knew what she was doing in setting Station 11 here, but I kind of doubt it. It's just one of those universal things about how humans move forward when things fall apart. But sometimes it's the universal that can feel so particular and even personal. My cold's getting better now. The electricity still works, and society still stands. But I do think I need a new disaster plan. Sorry, Petoskey.
The book is Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, and our book note from Michigan Radio's Tamar Charney. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Kevin Orr is expected to resign tomorrow after signing the order sealing Detroit's bankruptcy. Daniel Howes with the Detroit News wrote a column indicating Orr's tenure as Detroit's emergency manager could have been a lot more divisive. Mr. Howes joins us now. You argue Orr, a guy a lot of people like to hate, actually showed a lot more restraint than he had to in managing the city of Detroit. Give us some examples.
Well, I mean, he could have not paid the city council members. He could have not paid Mayor Bing or Mayor Duggan. He could have not agreed to share power and negotiate to share power with Mayor Duggan that he did. And it progressively gave the mayor more power. He could have been a lot more aggressive using the power of the emergency manager inside the context of federal bankruptcy to jam down concessionary contracts on the unions. Now, clearly, the contracts that were eventually negotiated in federal mediation were, in some measure, concessionary. But I think he understood that he needed key constituencies in the city, including elected officials, unions, union leaders, to some extent be partners in this enterprise, or it was going to be a lot worse once this process was over.
And a lot longer process, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
During the announcement of the settlement, Mayor Mike Duggan made the point that he and Orr did not always get along that well. The mayor's kind of made a joke of that over the months, but they were able to find a way to work together. Now, Orr granting the mayor the authority, as you mentioned, is something that I thought was extraordinary and an outreach by Orr that I didn't expect. Did you?
Well, I think ultimately I wasn't surprised that he did that. You know, they were law school classmates, although they weren't necessarily chums when they were at University of Michigan Law School. But they were contemporaries, and I think that, remember who Kevin Orr was working for. He was working for Governor Snyder, and I think recognized that they needed Mike Duggan as to some extent as a member of the team. He may not be attached to the hip, But he didn't want to be at cross purposes with the elected officials because that would have caused a lot more disruption and slowed things down. I was not actually that surprised. I remember talking to the mayor when he was mayor-elect, and it was very clear to me that they were trying to be very workmanlike and work out and work through the details of control. And the mayor, of course, wanted as much as he could get right out of the box. And Kevin Orr was a little more circumspect about that. He didn't want to give him control of the police department, initially didn't want to give him control of finance, although he ultimately did. Because of the implications for bankruptcy and in bankruptcy and negotiations with creditors. But all told, I think it was a pretty savvy move on Kevin Orr's part. You know, he is maligned for being the emergency manager, but I think he could have taken a much tougher line with a lot of constituencies than he ultimately did.
Some residents of Detroit say Orr and the bankruptcy gave away control of too many of the city's assets. How much merit do you give that argument?
Well, I'm of the school that a lot of the city's assets were, in fact, liabilities. And if you own something, it's like owning a home you can't take care of. You know, it ultimately falls apart, it starts to degrade, and your asset is worth less. And I think that is a fairly apt analogy for the city. There were assets that the city held, pieces of downtown real estate, for example. The Red Wings were going to finish playing in Joe Louis Arena. They were going to own Joe Louis Arena, and who was going to develop it? They were going to have to find a developer. In bankruptcy, they were able to find a developer who was a former creditor. So they take someone who is a creditor and turn them into an investor in the city. That doesn't mean that those assets go away. The city will still reap the benefits of the redeveloped property once it is redeveloped under agreement. And there are other examples of that. The DIA is another example. So I would say to a lot of those people, what's changed? The only thing that's changed is that the city doesn't have as many financial obligations for these assets as it had before bankruptcy.
So overall, how do you rate the kind of thankless job that Kevin Orr did steering Detroit through bankruptcy and turning the city back over to elected officials?
I think he did a pretty good job, if not a very good job, under very difficult circumstances. I think he clearly misjudged the political component of his job, and he made some missteps along the way. And one other thing I would give him credit for was fixing his mistakes, or at least trying to fix them. And covering CEOs, as I have for a lot of years, you see a lot of leaders who are not willing to acknowledge their mistakes or change course. And he did, and I think that deserves credit. Clearly, he was a bankruptcy technician. I had no doubt from the day he walked in the job and I looked at who he was and what his background was that they clearly were preparing to take the city into Chapter 9. And had you been watching what was going on under the consent agreement under Mayor Bing in the last council, it was fairly clear that the city leadership at the time was not prepared to do what needed to be done to avert bankruptcy. So I think it was very clear from the jump that Kevin Orr was there to do that. And I can remember talking with him early on, and he'd say things like, don't make me go there. But I became very convinced that that's where he was headed. And he did it, and he used the process in a pretty unforgiving way, particularly insofar as financial creditors were concerned. And now it looks like we're going to be on the other side of this any week now.
Daniel House is a business columnist for the Detroit News and a regular guest on Stateside. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, some of my friends in journalism say you should never, never, ever read the comments after a story online. You will read things that will just drive you nuts. Well, I do. I do read the comments. I can't help it. I want to know what people are thinking, not just about my stories, but stories other news media in Michigan publish. And occasionally I walk away from the experience thinking, wow, there's some good points made. Occasionally. Most of the time, I'm fuming. I mean, are people really that racist? Are there really that many people that are that uninformed? Are people really that mean and nasty to each other? Cliff Lampe is an associate professor at the School of Information at the University of Michigan, and he's worked with little outfits like Facebook, Wikipedia, studying community engagement like this. So welcome.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to be interested to see what you had to say about all this. First,
I read the comments too.
First, I want to ask you whether the comments are representative of the typical news consumer, or are these mostly people who are just really, really passionate? I mean, who comments?
But it's not typical of consumers of news overall. So it's only people who are willing to say extreme things, I think, who are willing to get into the mix of those comments. And I'm not sure it's passion that drives people to comment. I think it's more maybe a low threshold for conflict.
Okay. Well, I want to get into trolling, as they call it, a little later. I kind of think that maybe most of these people wouldn't make these kind of comments if it were a discussion in public. So why are they so agitated when they're making comments online?
A lot of it's about norms. So if you enable a site where the norms are to be able to say mean things to each other or to call somebody an idiot or to say racist things, then the norm for that site is that's what's said. And nuanced comments or comments that have more reflection or are more middle of the road get driven out of that normative environment.
So a moderated comment section like we have on Facebook at Michigan Radio, where if you say something that we can't say on the radio, it's going to get deleted. Or if you're mean to someone else and call them names, it's going to get deleted. We're going to have a more civil discussion.
Yes. And there's lots of great examples of comment streams that are more heavily moderated where you do see more civil discussions.
We hear the word trolls, like I mentioned, describing people who spend their time dropping incendiary comments into online discussions. Typically, what's the goal there and what's the reward for being a troll?
Amusement mostly, right? People who are trolls are purposely saying things that are incendiary to get reactions out of people. I don't think everybody who says incendiary things is doing that. There's a small group of people who are just amused by getting people to be angry at them. I think more of what's going on is actually there are people who disagree about these things. We're not actually taught anyplace how to disagree civilly with one another, right? It's considered impolite to bring up political conversations at the dinner table or in mixed groups. And so we don't do that. And we tend to surround ourselves with people who are a lot like us. So when you're in a comment stream on Facebook or on MLive comments or things like that, you're actually being exposed to people who really do believe things that are very different from what you believe.
Right. I read a study that people who rant online feel more relaxed after posting, but then they also experience more anger, and most express their anger in kind of maladaptive ways. So what are we to make of that? I think, a lot of angry people out there?
No, I think that the comments actually do have an effect. So having a negative comment thread really does change how people interpret the story. People become more polarized. People do feel more angry. They feel sadder about the state of the world. Having negative comments isn't just like, oh, well, that's the internet. It really is having a negative effect on how we think about things and how people interact with people around them.
I don't want to say everything I read is horrible and terrible. I've read some really elegant observations on current events, and I guess I feel like wading through those uninformed reactionary posts in between is just the price to be paid. I mean, is that any different than anything else in life? I mean, maybe it's just a little more concentrated online?
I don't think so. And I think part of the problem is this conflict, especially for journalists who are often running these comment threads. Journalists are really strong believers in First Amendment rights, right? Mm-hmm. They have an allergic reaction to anything they perceive as censorship.
Right.
And when they shut down comments, they only do so for cases you mentioned earlier, right? When really it might be more effective if they shut down a wider range of comments, not just people who swear or who say threats. But what if you're being uncivil? I think most journalists see that as, I can't really censor somebody because they're being uncivil in this context. But if you did, you would create a safer place for people to gather and to share their comments. So it might be more aggressive moderation. And that's usually the case of what happens when these comment systems work.
I've read that these comments after the news stories can sometimes change the perception of the actual news story. I wonder how common that is.
It's very common. You know, if the comment thread, for instance, is negative, people will have less trust in the journalism that's taken place in the story. They can shape how people think about the content of that story. If it's about, for instance, government, city government, federal government, it can change how people feel about the government. So, like I said, these are not harmless, just kind of people on the internet. This really is shaping how people think. And for every person who comments on a news story, there's this long tail of people who read that comment, right? So there are many more people who read comments on a news story than there are commenters, and we can't ignore the effects on that audience as well.
Some news outlets are shutting down the comments section. They're just banning it outright. What do you think of banning comments?
It makes sense in a lot of cases. I can definitely see why people do it. I think it's a shame, though, right? Because there's still a cyber utopian deep in my heart who feels like comments are a great place for people to share what they think and who have helped me think about a subject differently than maybe the perspective the journalist took. When you shut down comments, you throw out the baby with the bathwater, right? You really do lose the potential good that you get because that's kind of the easiest, in some ways, sloppiest way to control comments is to shut them off.
Cliff Lampe is at the University of Michigan, where he researches online behavior. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. When I took woodshop in high school a long, long time ago, the project was a step stool. Not very exciting. So to get high school students more excited about woodworking and to get them more active, an industrial arts teacher and a gym teacher got together and came up with a new kind of class. Kids can make their own longboard skateboard, a surfboard, snowboard, or skis. The class at Forest Hills Eastern High School in Grand Rapids is called Gone Boarding. Joining us now is the shop teacher, Bruce McCartney, and gym teacher Bill Curtis, who came up with this idea. So how'd you guys arrive at this?
First up, we kind of were doing the same projects like step stools and cutting boards, and my students just weren't buying into it. So a long time ago, I kind of asked them, what do you want to do? And they came back with skateboards. After a few failed attempts, we found success, and then that went on to longboards. The class enthusiasm just started to climb dramatically.
And I take it this idea that having something you can actually get physically active with in a generation that is better known for sitting around with video games is a big plus.
Absolutely. Bruce and I kind of put our heads together. As the physical education teacher, my goal is to get kids moving, get them active, not just while they're here in the high school, but we really try to build lifelong activity in them. So, kind of the same evolution happened from the phys ed standpoint. What are some activities that kids enjoy doing? And really, for me, it kind of started with snowboarding, because I think we have way too many young people who don't get out during the wintertime. It's an excuse for them to stay inside, play video games, sit on the couch. And for me, snowboarding is a way to promote activity. I love being outside in the winter now because of snowboarding.
You can't have a product without testing it out. Do you guys give them credit of any kind for making sure their project works?
Well, I think that's one of the things that the class may evolve into. Right now, we spend roughly half of the time out either in the water or on the slopes, actually snowboarding, surfing, stand-up paddleboarding, longboarding, and then the other half of the time is spent in the shop. If we could create a third half of time, I think we'd have more opportunities for actual product testing, product development, things like that.
I saw that you got some attention from Burton Snowboards. Tell me about that connection in Vermont.
Burton, they're the industry leader in snowboarding worldwide, and we actually connected a couple years ago with one of their independent sales reps who's on the other side of the lake in Chicago. His nephew was in our initial Gone Boarding class. He got wind of it actually over a Thanksgiving meal that they were having. His name is Matt Hoffman. He reached out to us and said, hey, what you guys are doing is unbelievable. How can I get involved? How can I help you guys out? Because at that point, we were still kind of in the fledgling stages of the class. That relationship has grown over the last couple years. What it did is turned into a visit by myself and 11 of our students to the Burton headquarters in Vermont. We were able to tour their entire facility, speak to a lot of their engineers, their designers, actually able to meet the owner and founder of the company, Jake Burton. And there's some really cool things in the works there in terms of partnerships between our Gone Boarding program and the Burton Snowboard Company. So we can't disclose everything that's going on there at this time, but I see some really positive things moving forward.
Oh, you can tell us. We won't tell anybody else.
Yeah.
Well, we will tell you the kids are ecstatic, and the number of students has increased in their interest for the class, and they're kind of chomping at the bit and trying to get in while we have the class running already, so it's pretty cool.
How do the kids feel about using their own boards, the ones they built, versus something that they could buy at a sporting goods store?
That is the best. It doesn't matter, how tough the kid is or what image they try to portray. As soon as they get on a board they've made, it's like a little kid at Christmas. It's pure pride, pure joy, and just that satisfaction. And it makes teaching worthwhile, I will tell you. They feel proud of themselves. They're using something that's now going to be a part of their life, not just, sit on a shelf or be a display.
I wanted to ask you about that. How does taking this class affect the kid's idea about a future career?
There aren't really any feeders really from high schools. And now a lot of them are thinking that way. We have a couple of kids that have joined our class because they want to dive into that realm.
And I think there are so many different careers that are available in the action sports industry. That was something that our kids, their eyes were opened up to at Burton. I mean, every company like that It's not just the glamorous professional writers that have jobs. You've got finance guys, you have marketing people, you have art designers, you've got all these different opportunities. And our kids are, I think they came in thinking that they were going to get some industrial design experience and they were going to get obviously some physical activity. But through a process of evolution here, they're getting business communications, they're getting science, they're getting math. And the beauty of it is they don't even realize they're getting it. So we don't have to force feed knowledge and information to these kids. They're going out and they're discovering it on their own, which so we can sit back and say, wow, these kids really get it. And it's a pleasure to kind of be the facilitators of this program.
That's Bill Curtis and Bruce McCartney, the creators of the Gone Boarding class at Forest Hills Eastern High in Grand Rapids. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Hey, thank you very much, Lester.
You bet, Lester. Have a great day.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Here's a name you've probably heard at one point or another, Dan Gilbert. Founder of Quicken Loans, owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, buyer of about 60 downtown Detroit buildings, Bedrock Real Estate Services, Fathead, Greektown Casino, the list just goes on and on. The national media have called him Detroit's savior, and coverage both nationally and in Michigan has bordered on boosterism. A couple of recent articles have questioned that portrayal and the news media's role in perpetuating the image that Dan Gilbert is single-handedly turning around Detroit. Ryan Felton wrote the article, Dan Gilbert, Downtown Detroit Demigod, for Metro Times. And Anna Clark wrote the piece, Detroit's Dan Gilbert and the Savior Complex, for the Columbia Journalism Review. And they're both here with me now. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Ryan, you wrote an extensive piece on Gilbert and Quicken Loans, and you thoroughly questioned whether Quicken Loans weathered the housing crisis by smart loan practices or whether it was also involved in some of these subprime loans to a lot of Detroit residents. Generally speaking, what kind of answer did you find?
That's a little bit more complex than I think Gilbert tends to let on. I think when you read interviews with him, he will just sort of put it in plain terms. You know, we didn't mess with those loans. We only sold plain vanilla products. And, you know, when you start contrasting that with some of, you know, the lawsuits that come about, some of just the background data that you find, it gets a little bit more nuanced, I think. And that's sort of, you know, what I arrived at. I couldn't really arrive at any sort of concrete conclusion. But I mean, there are definitely significant sort of allegations, you know, levied in lawsuits that sort of conflict with that image of just being this spit shine clean lender that, you know, that he's portrayed Quicken to be over the years.
Now, I want to be clear, though. We haven't been able to turn up hard evidence other than the accusations, allegations made in a lawsuit. It's not like Countrywide where, you know, we saw them fold because of their practices. And you note Ryan Felton's reporting is something as a rarity in Detroit, basically questioning if Detroit news media are not asking the hard questions of Gilbert and his companies, because the sense is he's helping Detroit turn around. So what do you think is missing in the coverage of Dan Gilbert?
Well, I think the story that Ryan tackled about what Quicken Loans' lending history in Detroit is it's been a long time coming. You know, it's a very complex story. And I think that's part of why, even though Dan Gilbert's been a very prominent figure in the area for many years now and has had it such a strong influence on downtown, the connection between what his particular company's lending history is in the Detroit area has not been fully scrutinized. I think a lot of times in a city that has been as deinvested in a city that has struggled as much as Detroit is, I think we can journalists can sometimes conflate a private business person with a charity or philanthropic figure, you know? And I think that's where some of this, like, savior idea comes from.
It's easier, though, and it's an easier storyline when you see what he's doing in the city, and a little bit tougher and takes hard work, like Ryan was attempting in his piece, to figure out, okay, what's the real story behind the image?
Right. I think the stories that we mostly see about Dan Gilbert are very timely pieces about when Gilbert, you know, buys a new building or when there's some new project going on and what...
or how he's trying to wipe out blight.
Absolutely.
Or like,
you know, these like very newsy stories that are, which are important and, but you are easier to do because you can just simply talk to a few people. You got the gist. You can write the story up. He got the building, you know, but this like deeper contextual story is hard. It is so hard to do. It takes resources. It takes time. Ideally, it takes more than one reporter. And I think the city has not totally mustered the journalistic fire to really take it on.
Ryan, you spent a good part of a day with Gilbert and several of his top executives at Quicken Loans, including what sounds to be let's say, an interesting tour of Quicken Loan properties. What was your impression of the man and the company as you were walking away that day?
He is a very smart individual who gave very professional responses to each of my questions. The same could be said for just about everyone that I interviewed that day. There definitely is something that I didn't include in the story, but there were a number of instances that came up where there was a concern expressed about these very types of storylines that I was writing about where it comes up. I mean, one line in particular was, you know, our image is the most important thing to us, was what one person said to me. I mean, I think that they really do treat with the utmost concern, you know, what their image is portrayed to the public. I think it was
evident. And quite critical of reporters who portray them in a way that they don't like.
Right. I mean, for instance, in the middle of our interview, he asked the other individual who was in the room with me to print out a 9-page point-by-point rebuttal of a story that was done in 2011 by the Center for Public Integrity. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're and it was very long-winded, and yeah, there's a very critical response to any story that has been done with that, you know, raises any sort of critical point.
I got the feeling at the beginning of your piece that there was this kind of public relations attempt at shock and awe for you, just to show you what a wonderful place it was to work, how much Dan Gilbert was doing for downtown, how awesome it was just to be hanging out with him that day.
That was one of the most perplexing parts, I think, of the day. I understand the fact that, you know, there is this sort of effort to present to outsiders, maybe visitors, guests, what is going on downtown, and I understand that. I'm not sure if there's another similar instance in this country where a private entity gives a sort of tour like that. I'd be interested to see if that's the case. But to give a reporter who works in the city, lives in the city, has been around the city for a while, a tour of places that he or she can visit on any given day, under the guise of just saying, isn't this something? It was, it really felt like just a blatant PR attempt to just, you know, kind of say, like, isn't this something that you're getting the chance to experience this? And it was very awkward because that's not why we arranged that day.
Right. It sounds like they were treating you like they might somebody from New York Times or the Washington Post or somebody from out of town.
Right. And, you know, why do that for an outfit in Detroit? I would even wonder if any of the outlets in Detroit, like the Free Press or the News, if they've been given a tour like that.
I want to ask you about an experience I had recently. I sat down with three generations of one family in the Jefferson Chalmers neighborhood, and they were talking about this disconnect between what's happening in downtown and Midtown, or they insist it's still Cass Corridor. I'm sorry, Midtown is just an invention, a label that's what they told me anyway. And they say there's this idea that there are the Gilberts, the Illiches, and Mike Duggan doing their thing in downtown and Midtown. It really doesn't have anything to do with what we're experiencing and living in the neighborhoods and trying to go to school and keep our jobs. Do you think that's a common disconnect between the residents of Detroit and people like Gilbert?
I think that's very common. I mean, there is no doubt that the day-to-day experience downtown is very, very different now than it was 5 years ago. So there's absolutely been a very visible and tangible impact, and this sort of sweeping tour that they give, you know, is meant to illustrate some real changes. But for people who do live here every day and aren't within a mile or so of downtown, it doesn't feel that different, you know? And I get that there, like, it takes a certain amount of time for citywide redevelopment to happen, but it is the revitalization of Detroit, quote unquote, tends to make Detroit synonymous with just the downtown Midtown area. And what I think a lot of residents feel is that their stories aren't sufficiently acknowledged as context for that. And I think the sort of PR day that, like, Ryan experienced, I think that sort of, like, reveals a certain assumption of the company, you know, that the journalists that they connect with do not know much about the city. I think that's troubling because, of course, there are plenty of reporters here with a lot of roots here and with a lot of knowledge here. And I feel like leveraging that is important.
I think, you know, there is something to be said about the fact that I didn't necessarily get the impression throughout the day that anybody involved in the company ever thought that their presence would necessarily grow as big as it did. So I don't think that they really thought that they would ever even get – Gilbert would ever get involved with, like, the blight removal task force. I don't think they ever foresaw that. But with that said, I think that there is this sort of disconnect. I mean, yeah, you know, every great city has a great downtown. I think that that's true. But every city, great city, isn't as big as Detroit is either. And I think that there still is, you know, this sort of huge disconnect between what is happening downtown and sort of, you know, how that, you know, it's juxtaposed within everywhere else. It kind of does raise the question that I think some reporters have recently, you know, suggested, is this revitalization, you know, legit? I think that...
Yeah, there's also the question of, is this, instead of trickle down, trickle out?
Sure.
Are these neighborhoods ever going to see any kind of real benefit from this? I also wanted to ask you guys, Gilbert seems to really insist on it's okay to make money, but this company also has a mission, and they are behind the blight removal effort, they're behind the M1 construction. They are doing good in that they're buying these buildings really cheap that have been deteriorating, empty for years, decades, and rebuilding them and occupying them.
Beautiful buildings, yeah.
You know, can you do that? Is that something that you see from companies? Usually you don't hear a company saying, not only are we going to make money, we've got a mission to actually do good.
Sure, and I think that that's – I can't remember it off the top of my head, what it's doing good by being good or whatever his phrase is. I mean, I think that there is something to that. Of course, they understand that they're a business. I think that that's a fundamental understanding of what they do. But I think that does just sort of, you know, to get back to an earlier point, translate to how the media portrays him here. I mean, it's a city that hasn't seen this kind of investment in, gosh, you know, decades, you know. And I think when you get to certain aspects of things, like, for instance, the Wayne County Jail, there's obviously a lot of problems involved in the Wayne County Jail. But when Dan Gilbert pens a letter that says, you know, this is one of the biggest mistakes ever, that immediately gets elevated to, you know, this is what Gilbert says about the jail, and that's a headline and that's a story. Anna wrote a great piece in Next City about what downtown jails could, you know, mean for a city and what that means for its residents. And you didn't see nothing similar like that here. And I think that, I don't know if it's necessarily problematic, but I definitely think it's fascinating that for whatever reason, we're not seeing a headline that says mixed reviews on what a downtown jail means, says experts or something. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I think that there's just this sort of dynamic going on where you have an individual who's done a lot to turn around the city that just immediately gets elevated to this platform that, you know, once he says something, that becomes a story. I think we've seen that time and time again.
I think the key part is that, like, I mean, with because Dan Gilbert has an outsized influence, you know, like certainly in his private investment, but obviously in his voice as well. And I think the thing to remember, you know, for reporters is like keeping that sort of like skepticism about you. So it's not necessarily that Dan Gilbert's this like awful guy or that he's done terrible things. You know, like it's not like there's some like scandal necessarily that's like meant to be uncovered, but it's just sort of like acknowledging that here's a person with disproportionate influence on the present of the city and certainly the future of the city. And so, and I think what gets tricky is that a lot of us as Detroit residents are really rooting for the city and hope that that influence really does, you know, do what he says and does like pay off for the good, you know, and that's where we get maybe a little caught up with some of our personal feelings and like wanting a savior, you know. But I think like the key thing is it's just like recognizing the power he has like within like our current culture right now at the city at this moment, and just keeping our skepticism about us, like not just like reporting something so because they said it so, you know, like just like acknowledging that there are other voices that matter, there are other realities that, you know, coexist with Dan Gilbert.
So last question, a double-barreled question, what do you hope to see from Dan Gilbert, and what do you hope to see from the coverage of Dan Gilbert in the coming year?
I guess I would hope to see that there is a this sort of fierce commitment that he has to accomplishing some of the tasks that he, you know, says he wants to see done. You know, I think particularly with the blight removal, but taking that one step further, what do you do when the blight is gone? I understand that they have ideas, you know, with what you could do with that, but I think, you know, it needs to be emphasized the fact that a guy who is handling a blight task force is a guy who makes mortgages. So, you know, I think that I want to—
And is a developer.
Right. And so I think, you know, what I would like to see is this fierce commitment that he says he has to tackling something like that, a complete understanding of what the outcome is, not just when you get it down, because I think that there is a much more complicated conversation there. Can you actually catch up to the amount of blight that is in the city? I mean, if you tear it down, are you going to stop the other blight that's still, you know, going to eventually
right.
occur? So I think that that is—
And with 62,000
right.
places potentially on the auction block next year.
Right. So I think, you know, to me, I think that that's probably one of the most, you know, important and interesting elements I think that does need to be sort of pushed is what is the plan beyond removing the blight? Because we do know that there is money built into the bankruptcy plan to see some more homes come down. But I still think that there's kind of just this open-ended question as to, okay, we want to get the blight down, but what's the plan after that and who benefits from that?
Anna?
Well, I would love to see stories about that. A few other stories that I would love to see would be some kind of exploration of the relationship between the Gilbert-owned buildings, the Gilbert companies that own the buildings, and the tenant businesses. A little bit more understanding of like what lease agreements are, how it's working, what, how long they stay, are they successful? Does the Gilbert company have some kind of stake in that? You know what I mean? I don't know. I would love to see something like that threaded out more. I would also love to see reporters get beyond the point where we let the sort of Gilbert narrative get ahead of us. There was, for example, a TV report this past year that proclaimed that Dan Gilbert had, like, quote, snapped up the Wayne County Jail property when, of course, nobody's purchased that yet. He had just submitted some sketches, and it just remained like that. It just remained headline like that, you know, for on and on and on. You know, it was just clearly wrong. and I think sometimes we get a little carried away with, like, assuming that Gilbert momentum downtown is, like, just unstoppable when we're telling that story even before it happens. And so I think I would really love to see reporters sort of, like, just be aware of what other forces are exerting power, like, believe it or not, the public sphere. You know?
So pull back, take a little bit more critical scrutiny of what's happening in downtown and, mm-hmm. and not just play into the narrative.
Absolutely.
That is Anna Clark. She writes for the Columbia Journalism Review. And we also heard from Ryan Felton. He writes for the Metro Times. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focused on? What issues do you want to hear more about? Let us know. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and at MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. And while you're there, catch up on stories and interviews you might have missed. Also, on Facebook, just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. Stateside's executive producer is Whipcracker Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty, thanks for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.